Thanks, Andrew. Who are the people investing in Go Solar? You were talking there about $1.5 billion and your projections of another $10 billion. So who's seeing things in the South African economy that those who play in the stock market perhaps are not?
Well, it's interesting, and we've got some of that's out in the public domain. So we've been fortunate. The founders of the business could only take this through pretty much a POC phase. Solar subscription takes a lot of capital because we fund everything as a business. So the founders led the business for about a year, and we were very fortunate to have one of our largest banking partners in the country, Standard Bank, come on board. So Standard Bank is one of our providers of debt, and is actually also a minority shareholder in Go Solar. We also have an international shareholder with international flavor. That's a climate-based investor that's actually sitting in the audience here. So there's a lot of support globally to support global net zero targets. And then we also have African Rainbow Capital, which is listed on the JSE, that have also come in recently and have invested in us and have been very supportive.
That's an interesting point. You have seen a flood of capital out of South Africa, not a heck of a lot coming in. Is it something that, and it's a fantastic story, if it were a normalized society, I guess the money that would be drawn to sectors like yours and businesses like yours would have been many times what it is. What might turn that over? What might be the tipping point there?
Well, I think it's a lot about confidence, Alec. I think sometimes our perception of the reality back at home is a lot worse than it is. I'm not saying there's not problems. I mean, there are a host of problems. But I think South Africans' perception generally of the problems is elevated. I think obviously the previous speaker just mentioned there's problems everywhere, but there's still the confidence in those markets. So I think this energy crisis has catalyzed an industry with a whole bunch of great players, not just us, that have come forward with confidence and with an investable proposition. And there's lots of talent still left in South Africa and lots of leaders, but often our leaders are not confident enough to attract that capital, because capital flows where it's looked after and where there's confidence that return can be protected.
So you are an actuary.
Well, I studied actuarial science, but I realized very soon that wasn't for me. So I didn't go in, rattle my boards, and I've never practiced as an actuary, but I've studied actuarial science.
And then you went into investment banking.
Yes.
Where I'm going with this is that you could see all kinds of opportunities. So what pulled you here?
Well, I think I told you in breakfast this morning, Alec, I loved investment banking. Actuarial science was a great thing to study, but then I realized I wasn't that interested in value and pension fund liabilities and assets. Great job, but it wasn't for me. And then investment banking, I thought, was one of the greatest careers to grow up in corporate finance at a number of the big banks. And there I worked in mergers and acquisitions and raising capital. So one day I wanted to do something more entrepreneurial and something that had some purpose and could solve a major problem. So we looked at a number of things. I got one or two like-minded mentors people with me that wanted to start something. We weren't sure that it was solar, but we knew it was something that had to have impact. And my core skill at the time was raising capital. So we looked for something capital intensive, infrastructure based, because often the problems that we're talking about, water, internet, these things are all infrastructure related. So we felt we could raise the capital if the model was correct. And then very quickly it was quite straightforward to see that the solar industry wasn't quite scaling the way it should have, despite all the fundamentals that I've mentioned that were in its favor.
And South Africa, because presumably you could have taken your qualifications and exported yourself.
I'm a very proudly South African, so as I say, a very bullish South African. I too could live somewhere else. I've got multiple passports, but I choose to live in Johannesburg because that's my home and that's what I want to see prosper. And I love traveling, love being in here in London. But I think South Africa is my home, and I think there's a lot of great people there. If we put our minds to it, we can solve those challenges. So again, my call to action is for everyone here to vote and come back. And I believe there's 2 million South Africans living abroad. This is some of the stats I've seen. Only 78,000, I believe, is registered to vote. That's quite sad. I think we need to get those 2 million people to vote and spend some more time contributing to the country that that helped them grow, because I think there's huge opportunities. And if we just bring a portion of those two million people back home, imagine the positive spin-off that would have.
One of the scariest words, though, for people in South Africa and certainly those outside is load shedding. Just explain to us what it is and how it came about and how it affects the psyche and what you guys are doing to address it.
Sure. So, I mean, it's a very nice term for what effectively is this rolling blackout. So what other countries will call rolling blackouts, which do happen in other countries, they're usually event-driven, some kind of weather event or wildfires. So, but around, I think it's 2007, 2008, so that's now 16 years of load shedding. The term was coined, and it's probably just a softer term than rolling blackouts. And it's unfortunately just escalated over the last 16 years, and it's really been driven by the lack of investment in power generation and distribution and transmission. So some of the really positives that France mentioned earlier around electrifying the population, which are all fantastic things post 94, were done, but there were a few missing gaps there that, you know, when you are electrifying the population from 49% to 80%, you need to invest in that infrastructure. And unfortunately, that was done too late. And even the new investment that has happened hasn't been managed the way it should have. So that's what's led to this. We've got a power supply demand deficit. And this is just to bring us back to equilibrium. But we need to grow the economy. So we need a lot more power. So that's why this notion that the short-term fixes, we're just going to bridge the gap this year and then there's going to be no load shedding. That assumes the economy just goes sideways. And the effect on the psyche in South Africa has been profound, because it's very difficult to see hope when you come home and you're in the dark and you can't cook and you can't work and you can't, you know, educate your children. So I think that has led to a huge negative sense of pessimism in the country, which we have to solve, yeah.
After lunch, we're going to have Gigi Alcock and Warren Wheatley talking about the informal economy. Gigi, who was grown up in that area, and Warren, who's, I suppose, a little bit like our Muhammad Yunus of Grameen Bank, where they're doing stuff to bring the money into the informal sector. You must have done a lot of thinking about this, about the, you know, if we're at 0.7%, how transformative it could be if you could put a solar panel on the roof of every house in the country. What ideas have come up that you might be able to implement if money was no object?
Yeah. So there are a lot of companies that have tried it, and there are a lot of global case studies where it's working. So we take comfort in that. I don't think it's been cracked yet locally. I think there's been a couple of things that have led to that. I think the technology is getting more affordable every year, but it still wasn't quite at the level where something of quality can be put into every home. What companies like ourselves won't do is go and put inferior quality infrastructure into these markets, because then you're really not solving the problem. So I think that's starting to shift. There has been some philanthropic models where some philanthropy can support the business case for it. And yeah, there's a lot of distributed microgrids solutions, containerized solutions, using secondhand equipment ideas that have been used, which has got a long useful life, but maybe is not potentially working in a business any longer and needs to be upgraded but can be repurposed. A big thing with the industry that's growing is we need to think about the recycling of the materials, the repurposing of the materials, which is the same with any industry growing, but there's a lot of things that can be done to prolong the lifespan and repurpose the technology for different markets.
Yeah, I guess people in London don't really know about the waste collectors that we have in South Africa. Guys who repurpose your garbage every day, and there are a whole army of them who do that. So if you translate that into an industry like solar, that surely will be a potential business area. But Gigi has an army of entrepreneurs, casipreneurs, as he talks about. Is there anything there that is blindingly obvious that you could perhaps kickstart?
I think so. I think what's really important around building infrastructure in informal economies is you've got to have community buy-in and support. I think companies often go in and think, look, I'm doing a good thing, so I'm just going to come and build it and it's all going to work. But I think those are often not sustainable models. So I think where you've got access to community leaders and connected members of society, small business owners within those communities, and you get their buy-in, then you can create a sustainable business model. I don't think you can just go in there. We can just add something to our website and just say, okay, click for this product. I think it's going to take some time to develop the community support for it.
Yeah. I'll tell you where I'm going. We've got one of the poorest countries in South Africa is Malawi. And we have our two members of our production team who live in Lilongwe. And they've got a little solar panel and a Starlink connection, internet connection. Yep. And they are among the most productive members of our team. A little solar panel and a Starlink, and they're living in Malawi.
Yeah.
If you translate that into the South African context, where a lot of people are far more advanced than the conditions that these two are having to do it in, it just opens your eyes to the potential and the possibilities. And that's why I'm thinking from your side, what would you suggest there that we could start putting the Kazipreneurs to work on?
Yeah, well, I think we have to support those technologies and those and the regulatory framework needs to be supportive. I mean, you can see Starlink is actually illegal, for instance, in South Africa, which is crazy. But there are fortunately fiber companies that are building in those areas, and there will be solar companies that will be there as well. But it has to be a conducive environment for that infrastructure to be firstly legal and then also protected, because you know, I think Paul's mentioned high crime levels. The crime levels in those areas are even higher than in some of the more higher income households. So this infrastructure is expensive. It needs to be maintained, and that's why I think the community buy-in is really important, so that is looked after. Yeah.
But you would have been illegal in South Africa, 3 years ago? What are you doing?
No, we wouldn't, because we are we're not the business 100 megawatt business.
But there was 1 megawatt was the cap.
Yes, yeah.
And you're doing 75.
Yes.
But so you'd have been in trouble, surely.
Yeah, well, it's counted on an individual site basis. So we do, the biggest we'll do is a 12 kilowatt system. So we would have been fine. But the change from 1 megawatt to 100 has had a profound impact on the industry from a commercial and industrial perspective. So that's why if the right laws are put in place, the conditions are there and the industry will continue to boom.
But it's amazing that, isn't it? Again, getting back to the steel, if you just put the right opportunities in place, as has happened in the solar market, you can get an explosion of economic activity.
Yeah.
What about affordability of this in South Africa? I'm one of your clients. I love your product. It's amazing. and I know that for me, it's affordable. Perhaps for somebody who's not doing the work I'm doing, it wouldn't be that affordable. How does it go? And can you put that in a context for a British audience?
Yeah, so it's getting there. So I think we've launched our entry level product is 1399. So in a British context, that's about 60 odd pounds per month. So that might sound affordable for a British household, but that still is isolating. I think that was the chart I showed earlier, the circles. It's isolating 15 million out of the 18 million households that we've got in South Africa. So I think the price points need to come down on the subscription side. The outright purchase of solar has just been completely off the table for those households. So the price points need to come down. There are some of the solar companies that are we work with, even our competitors are starting to look at those areas. So it's all happening. So I think everyone's got a role to play, and others will have new ideas, fresh ideas. But I think it's coming, and we just need to get the cost down. It's still too expensive. Yeah.
Software as a service, solar as a service.
Solar as a service, that's
okay.
It.
Okay. Some questions. Tim asks, Andrew, how are you managing the BBBEE requirements, and where do you see those requirements moving in the future with the government?
At the moment, because of our early size, there's certain exemptions that you get, and as we grow, it's something that we'll continuously work on. We have, you know, we have some shareholding now that we get via African Rainbow Capital. We've got a very diverse workforce. Procurement's there, so it's just part of business in South Africa. I'm not sure the second part of the question, where is it going? That's not something I'm an expert on, unfortunately.
Dirk says he's interested in kinetic storage.
Okay. I guess, is he talking about pumped storage, for instance? Where you can put, no? No? Yeah. Well, I guess it's just another form of battery, right? So let's just take pumped storage, which we do have, which is great, is you've got excess power during the day because you've got solar energy, you've got demand has dropped, so you don't want this power to be wasted. So we have batteries where it goes into. But another form of battery is if you were, for instance, to pump water uphill in the Drakensberg, which they do, and you leave it there high up, and that's potential kinetic energy. And then during the evening when you've got the deficit, you let that water go down and run across turbines. So although that's not a lithium battery or a Duracell battery that we think about, it's just a moving energy from one form to another so that you can use it later. And that, yeah, I'm very, very bullish on that. And I think we need more examples of that. And I think one of the challenges in the solar industry that's getting overcome with storage is that it's this mismatch that I spoke about. It doesn't solve the issue in the evenings. But now these large solar farms that are getting built in South Africa, the biggest one being ScarTech, which has just been announced, has put a huge battery next to the solar because that's going to be the future. That, you know, you've got certain hours where you can get the energy and you need to store it for when you don't have the solar power production.
Is that an area you would get into, kinetic energy?
No, I think we all stay with residential for now. There's lots to do, and we want to be specialized. I don't see it being something that can be done at a household level yet on scale. We're more focused on enabling the household to use solar energy and enable the smart home and electric cars in the future. I know there's some views around electric cars. Certainly, we see that as something that is coming in the future. If you just look around London and you look at that, it's going to take time. But I think electric vehicles, if you look at what the major motor manufacturers are saying, if they stick to that, you're only going to be able to drive your old combustion engines if you've got secondhand ones. So it'll take some time, but I think we'd be more interested in that space than kinetic energy for now.
Dean says, how do the feed-in tariffs work for Go Solar clients?
So at the moment, the feed-in, this is going to be a big year for feed-in. So Cape Town is leading the charge, City of Tshwane.
Just explain what it is, feed-in tariffs.
Feed-in tariffs is when you can take your excess power and you can sell it back to your municipality or to Eskom. We estimate alone on our production, 40% of our power last year that we could have produced wasn't produced because energy needs somewhere to go. So if your batteries are full at home and you're not producing enough, even though your solar panels and it's a sunny day can produce more, they won't because the power needs somewhere to go. Because in most municipalities, all municipalities effectively until this year, you weren't able to sell it back to the grid. And now Cape Town has led the charge with that. So effectively, we'll help our customers, we'll enable them to sell back. It still is, a lot of work is required to make feed-in a reality. At the moment, you need to change your meter. So again, I don't want to get too technical, but you need a meter that can read electricity being bought and sold. Most of the meters in South Africa only know that you're buying. So that needs to be changed, and the investment is placed on the household. So that investment's too high at the moment. So you wouldn't do it because you'll never get a payback on, you'll get a marginal payback on your capital. But certainly Cape Town has got the right model, and I believe City of Tshwane will be next, and hopefully Johannesburg next, and then everyone with excess solar power will now sell that into the grid, and that'll be good for municipalities because they will buy it for cheaper than they buy the power from Eskom.
Okay, but I got a personal interest here. Am I going to get a little bit back when Hermanus Municipality takes my power?
Yes,
from Go Solar.
Yes, you will. Yeah, well, you'll get it back on your bill. So we won't. You won't get it from us, but you'll get it from your bill. Yeah.
Progress. John asks. He says it's become a problem for house sales here in the UK. So how does your subscription model work when houses are sold?
Yeah. So I think there is a negative stigma in the UK around it, because there were some issues around solar leasing, and effectively, I'm not close to the detail, but we have been meeting some solar companies in the UK, and effectively, the solar subscription model, like us, works more on an upfront ownership transfers hands to the household, and then it's paid off over 20 years because of the concerns around how the previous in the UK how that solar loan impacted your sale of house. But in South Africa, in our model, it's no impediment. We actually think having solar on your home is a net positive to selling your house, because often, or to lease it out, because people don't want to buy a house in South Africa without backup power because of the fear of grid energy. But if you want to sell your house and your new buyer doesn't want, either we help transfer the contract to the new buyer, or it's a cancellation and then we deinstall, and we have a few of those. We've got very few cancellations in the business, but that's really the transfer of ownership is when often there's a new decision maker and they decide not to do it. So it's not embedded like in the UK forever that you can't get out of it and then it impacts on the sale.
Yeah, that's probably the important part as well. What are your cancellation terms?
Yeah, so you can cancel with a month's notice. We do charge a cancellation fee, depending on the size of your product and how long you've been with us. And that's really just to recoup costs so that we can, because we don't charge upfront for installation. So if you cancel within a certain period, we need to effectively go and take that, send a team to take it and put it somewhere else. So there's a charge there, but our customers like it because of the flexibility.
Where did you get that from? Because if you think about solar as a service and the investment that you make upfront, clearly, you wouldn't want people, well, the typical role would be 18 months or a 2-year contract, etc. And yet with yours, that doesn't exist. Where did that come into the thinking?
So we take in the view, and I think some of our competitors and out there in banks are locking people in, 3, 5, 7 year term. We felt that lock-in was not the best solution for households, and we've seen, as I say, very, very few cancellations for it. And we believe that once you've got solar, not just the benefits for having uninterrupted power, but the cost savings that are coming through as we reach price parity with the municipal prices, why would customers really cancel as long as we're doing a good job? So it's part of our philosophy that we're your solar provider. We'll help you. We'll make sure it works. We'll repair the equipment when it needs maintenance. And you've got the option to cancel, but we don't believe you will if we do our job correctly. So we create that alignment between the household and us. It's not one of those where you pay a few hundred thousand for it. Good luck. If it doesn't work, don't call me. I'm not coming back. You know, so you've got to back that we're going to have the customer service and quality. And so far, it looks good. But if we tie people in, we think that they wouldn't want, they'd be less reluctant to buy it, and you would have that home transfer issue that I think sits in the UK where it's a 20-year contract.
It's so interesting. I've got a business partner who's a really smart guy, and he says, I bet against the state. And so much of what he does, he bets against. And in a way, you're betting against the public sector here, because you, if you are more efficient and the prices of Eskom or electricity go up, then you're going to be even more appealing.
Yeah, so we don't think about it quite like that, but I can understand how they can see that. Look, the reality is we had electricity prices that were incredibly cheap for a very long time, and that was, we had access to very cheap coal, and Eskom was well run. So it was one of the selling points, I think, for South Africa. Come invest. We've got excess power, cheap power, and probably it stayed. The prices stayed very low for long. So South Africa's prices are going up, but still on a global context, they're still on the bottom half of the curve, bottom quartile. So prices are a lot higher around the world. So even if the situation improves, and it is starting, we are starting to see some signs there, we expect that prices just have to go up because there's just such an underinvestment in the grid infrastructure and Eskom. So prices need to go up, and I think that'll be in line with global prices. And globally, solar cost per kilowatt of solar power is going down everywhere. So that's why I say it's going to be part of the mix. It's not going to be the entire part of the mix, but it's going to be a big piece.
Powerful, powerful model. Haley says, what work is being done in the industry to reduce environmental impact down the line, e.g. lifespan of solar panels, creating waste and passing on environmental issues to future generations, etc. And are concerns around future waste in the solar industry causing issues for investment currently?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And there's a whole industry that's developing. So we have service providers already that we sign up that are planning to responsibly dispose of, recycle these components when they reach end of life. They've got a long lifespan. So take solar panels, 25 to 30 year lifespan. So we haven't quite seen all the replacement cycle there, but there's a lot in there that can be repurposed, you know, the metals, the silica. So that needs to be done properly by proper companies and responsibly disposed of. You can't dispose of certain components in hazardous components in any landfill in South Africa, and lots of African countries don't have the ability to dispose of that yet. So that's an industry that's evolving, and we're working with the industry to build that. But it's, again, it's a global solution is required for that. But it's no different to if you were to dispose of nuclear waste in that manner, right? Which has also got its own challenges. So with all industries, you've always got to think about the 20-30 year. Down the line, with the mining industry, you've got to think about mine rehabilitation, and that's what happens. There's financial products actually that are used for that. So it's going to be the same with solar. Yeah,
Andrew, maybe to close off with, can you give us some sense of the growth in the market in South Africa, maybe using importation of solar panels?
Sure. So what we know from Eskom data, which is still really good, is that 2.6 gigawatts of solar was added last year alone, and that takes the solar end of last year to 5.4 gigs. So it almost doubled last year. So last year we nearly doubled. This year the industry is probably it's gone up about 260 megawatts in the first quarter. So that's about a tenth of last year, 3 months down the line. So it is slower than last year, but still growing significantly.
But why would it have slowed down?
The perception is that in South Africa, at least, that it's really something that you go for when there's load shedding. It still isn't universally accepted as an energy source sustainably in the future for sustainability, our environment, and our financial wallet, which is, you know, the households in South Africa are increasingly under that pressure. So in the UK, where solar is doing really well, despite the cloudy weather, it's a savings product. It's regulated by the financial services industry here because it's seen as a financial product that you buy.
And so where's South Africa on that curve?
We are very confident in Cape Town, which has got the highest energy prices of any municipality, that there's a saving for you now on average over the year. Obviously, it changes in winter and summer. And then in Eskom direct customers are also at parity, and then places like Johannesburg are probably 12 to 18 months away from price parity. So it's very close to being the cheapest source of energy in most municipalities. At the moment, people are taking a view on the future energy prices and obviously the other benefits of solar.
And your costs, what's happening to them, your hard costs, your importation of panels, for instance?
Yeah, they're all getting better and more affordable in US dollar terms. Solar panel pricing for the last 15 years, it almost looks like Moore's Law. If you guys follow Moore's Law, it's exactly the same. So solar panel pricing is really, is coming down more and more. Lithium batteries and other types of chemistry in batteries are getting invested. There's huge R&D globally, China, US, everywhere spent on this technology. So it's come down. We've obviously got our rand cost has gone up, and that's the installation, the labor component. But overall, our costs are significantly down from this time a year ago.
And I just to close off with, there is concern about the infrastructure in South Africa on every level. The grid has to be part of that as well. So if I hear you correctly, the costs, Moore's Law is at work now, as far as your business is concerned. And on the other business, on an Eskom business, it's going the other way with difficulties on transmission. So that would tend to suggest that the growth might accelerate more than just the load shedding element.
Yeah, so I think it's been well publicized as well by the electricity minister, the next challenge, and I think they've successfully separated the entities now. So for those that don't know, Eskom has now been separated legally, or it's got, there's a few steps just to go, but it's nearly there in terms of generation and transmission and distribution, which is a good step because generation should be, we should get the energy mix agreed and make sure that it's the right mix for South Africa, and we should try and get the cost of power down, and that is going to require private actors. The distribution side is very much run by municipalities, and municipalities need help because their balance sheets are not where they need to be. So that's your last mile infrastructure. But the transmission piece, you know, that's a difficult one because there's not many global case studies where private participation is there yet because it's a natural monopoly. You know, it gets built, and if it's not looked after, it's very difficult to replicate. There's not going to be private capital that can replicate the grid infrastructure. So it's going to have to be a public-private partnership. And I think that's, again, one of the benefits of embedded generation on your business, on your household, is that you're not reliant on that grid. So if we can at least, for the time being, until we can get that grid infrastructure up to where it needs to be, if a large portion of your power can be produced and consumed on site, then you can take the strain off the grid. It's not just a South African problem. There's lots of literature. The US has had huge issues with their grid as well. It's just something that gets built 100 years ago, and there's never any competition in it because it's a natural monopoly. And then natural monopolies are not good for anything, right? That's why the solar industry exists right in South Africa, because of a monopoly. Yeah.
Andrew Middleton, thank you. It was fascinating.
Thanks for having me.